came like a stranger in the night. And praise the Lord, I saw the light.
I was thinking about the $90 billion in funding that they cut from Corporation Public Broadcasting. And here in Houston, our Houston Public Media, at one point in time in like 2022, they were announced this new deal or this new show. It was like a mini series, a video series called Counteract, Envisioning the Future of Energy in partnership with Chevron that they wrote.
Back when all the oil companies were doing like green energy initiative shit. Yeah.
Kind of. The thing was, like, they say in partnership, and I think it came out that it was like completely sponsored content, and like Chevron wrote all the scripts. And so they pulled everything, but nothing aired. They pulled all of it. And at the time, I remember thinking, like, this is fucking ridiculous. Why would you do something like this? And now, seeing that, I still think it's ridiculous, but now seeing, you know, Houston Public Media, it went from a $19 million company to a $17.5 million company after these CPP cuts, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, it's $2.5 million or $1.5 million. Anyway, long story short is that I believe that now that they're seeing those kind of budget cuts, and other stations will feel this impact a lot heavier than Houston, they're going to start having like a lot more sponsored content like this.
Oh, I'm sure. What,
whether or not we should have state-sponsored media, I don't know. That's a question for a different podcast.
We've been watching HBO's The Pitt. I don't know if you guys have seen any of that. But that is, I would say that's very functional. I don't know if it comes from a political angle or an industry angle, but it's pretty effective propaganda for healthcare and hospitals.
Yeah.
And doctor, I just say like the hospital sector and also like it does a bunch of kind of I'd say like public service stuff about illnesses and like doctors and the importance of like, I don't know, using condoms and right, like not taking like street pills. Right. And I think it combines that with a pretty entertaining show. And it would be the kind of thing that like a very polished state would make to, if you wanted to like to propagandize to a populace. Right. Mm-hmm. But this is like very, very effective. I'd say it's sometimes a little bit preachy, but not terrible. Right.
That's fine. Doesn't the whole season take course over like one day, like one shift or something?
Yeah. One shift. So it's like every hour in like a, I guess like an 8 or 10 hour shift.
Is there somebody who's just like pooping the whole time?
Pooping the whole time. There is a recurring gag where like one of the intern doctors just keeps getting shit on his scrubs, like blood and vomit, and then like at some point somebody spills like Pepto Bismol all over his.
So he's just like covered in Pepto for the rest of the season.
No. He's got to go get new scrubs. He's got to go keep going to like the scrub vending machine and changing them out. Good morning,
hey, Hayden. Oh,
hey, he's might be there.
Yeah, I had to restart everything and replug in my mic. The whole computer just blew up for a second.
Uh-oh.
Not sure what's up there, but that's okay. In the middle of moving, which is very fun.
Where are you moving to?
Back to America. I live in Austria, so we're heading back to the U.S. of A.
Auf Wiedersehen, as they say.
Yeah, tschüss for the colloquialisms here. But how are you guys doing?
Good. A warning. America's a little different now. Mm-hmm. I don't know when the last time you were here.
I've been hearing some really good things, so I thought we'd go check it out. It's definitely not that the job market is taking a shit or anything like that. But
it's funny that you're returning from Europe. I'm considering leaving and going back to Europe.
Yeah, that was kind of like it's not at my own insistence or choice, basically.
I see.
Brought you all the way out there to Austria?
Yeah, so my best friend, him and his brother, weirdly enough, married a pair of Austrian sisters, which is a long story. It was a whole thing. But yeah, and I spoke a little German from high school. So during the first Trump term, my wife and I were like, let's consider not living here right now. And, you know, she's had a few health issues. So we were like, let's find a place that has, you know, socialized medicine, the kind of things that would make living a little bit more affordable. And so I ended up finding a job for this company that made like a run tracking app owned by Adidas. They don't exist anymore, though. And so I don't have a job, and neither does the second job I almost had, which was with KTM Motorcycles. They closed as well. Things are bad right now, folks. They are not great.
Where so in America do you think you're going to be landing?
Well, so we're both from Washington area. Okay. So Washington State. So Northwest is typically, yeah, that's kind of, I've got family all around that area and friends and stuff like that, you know. We're in our 30s now, so starting over in some random places with no connections is not as ideal as it once was. Not as exciting. How about you guys? Where are you guys at?
I'm in Houston, Texas. Been here almost my whole life. I was actually born in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Came over here really young for medical reasons. Houston's got that great med center. And I just like, never left. I had some opportunities to like move to Alaska when I was a radio journalist.
Okay. That didn't entice you.
it honestly did. It just like never took, or just like it never ended up being the exact right time because I was young in my head. It's like, I need all these things to happen. I mean, the great thing about Houston is it's a city that rewards you the longer you stay in it.
Oh, nice.
So I've got like an incredible support system.
That's good to hear. That's nice.
And then I grew up, we went to high school together. And then after college, I moved, ironically, to Lake Charles to work in the oil field. And I've never left. So kind of a third, fourth tier American city, but it's quiet and it's slow and it's very cheap. So
You're from Poland.
There you go. So that's where the propaganda side of it comes in, right?
me doing it on behalf of the Polish government. An effective propaganda outfit of the Polish government.
That's right.
I don't think we've ever really discussed our origin story on this podcast, but Alec and I came up in our high school debate team together.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I know.
Yeah, really. Our spouses love it. And so now... We both were like kind of conservative. We ran the Student for Ron Paul chapter at our high school.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
And then we left home, lived life. And nervously reconnected like years later. Like, there's a podcast called Chapo Trap House. Do you like it?
So you still into this Ron Paul stuff or have you grown up a little bit?
We're big Ron Paul heads in 2025. It's just like the guys who just hang on.
I'm pretty sure that's
long.
Just like the guys who are fans of his Nazi content in his newsletter. Those have got to be the only like the Richard Spencer type hangers on.
The dudes were like, he used to be good.
Now he used to be cool.
Yeah, like most teenagers, we just hated our parents and became libertarian. The funny thing about it, though, is a lot of we started the chapter and everyone who showed up to the meeting just wanted to legalize weed. And we were like, we came here to talk about economics, y'all.
That is the Ron Paul
If you introduce a 15-year-old to the concept of a political ideology who's like general policies are legalize weed and no rules, right? That's going to be pretty popular with 15-year-olds.
The Bart Simpson platform, you know.
Teachers, and the government's basically a bunch of teachers.
Nice. They know how to get you. Anyway, let's go ahead and get started here. It is July 19th. 2025 at 10 a.m. CST, not for our guest here, but we are very, very excited, Propagandos, to welcome the host of the Bible Lore podcast. Please give a warm welcome to Hayden Tank. Hayden, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Good to talk about all things Angel Studios movie production.
Somewhat serious academic podcast now on our show, which is very fun.
I bring on the academics. I am not. I make no claims around that myself. I am just some asshole who likes to read books. So I let all the smart people do the real talking on there. But glad to be here. I did. I have an episode coming out with Jordan from Brigham Young Money podcast, SLC Lunk on Twitter and other platforms. And we talked about The Chosen. And boy, that was my first like real introduction to Angel Studios. And it is it's so interesting. I guess we'll get into it in a bit, but like their stated goal seemed to always be to escape the low quality of Christian entertainment and Christian art, I guess you could say, while also not being Hollywood. But realistically, it feels like they just put a veneer of prestige TV production over like the same exact stuff that you would get from Christian contemporary art and popular level art like 25 years ago.
That's their sales pitch mostly to investors, right? In at first the Mormon community and now kind of abroad. And it's extremely funny that, you know, they, especially early on, they underline that, right, that our practices are going to be different than Hollywood. And then over the course of several years, embroiled themselves in many legal battles where they were basically just absolutely fucking over people whose content they were hosting and distributing. And like it should be said, right, Angel Studios is mostly not run by artists. It's mostly run by a bunch of Mormon finance guys, right?
Yeah.
Which explains a lot.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of these guys probably trained in the same like circles as like Mitt Romney and Bain Capital, like these are guys who know how to wheel and deal and strip things of all the copper wiring in the walls. That is their expertise.
It's MBA guys, right?
Yeah.
Worst kinds of people. I mean,
if you've heard the conspiracy theory that A24 is just a private equity firm, like I believe Angel Studios is also doing that. You know, you mentioned The Chosen. I'm sure you've known this by now, but they've had quite an acrimonious split with the production team of The Chosen. Chosen wants nothing to do with them anymore.
Which is funny because like Dallas Jenkins being a really savvy business guy as well and being the person who knows how to straddle that line, trained by his dad in that, he never had a bad thing to say about those guys, despite pushback from somewhat within the evangelical community because they're Mormons. So like that's always been kind of a point of tension of like, is there going to be, you know, because these are all conspiratorial people anyway who are looking for a demon behind every bush. So like within some of the evangelical circles, you'll say occasionally see like cranks that are like, oh, that's like Mormon stuff because it was so, you know, it filmed at the Mormon sets in Utah and stuff like that to stand in for Jerusalem. It is interesting that they split considering how much nice stuff he had to say about those guys.
Well, it paid to be connected to him. By the way, Dallas Jenkins, creator and director, and I think producer of The Chosen, at least some of the early seasons.
Yeah. And his daddy made the Left Behind series.
Right.
And a guy who's kind of, you know, we can only assume, right? We only really see the PR versions of people online, but who seems actually fairly dedicated to this idea of spreading the message by making, you know, the message of Christ through creating actually palatable media, right, that aren't just either cash grabs or slop.
In Angel Studios, they are also trying to branch into the mainstream. They've since distanced themselves from their original Christian mission statement, and now they're just saying, like, look, we just make movies that bring light. We just bring light to people. Mm-hmm. So Sketch coming out August 6th. I got, as a guild member, I got 2 free tickets coming my way.
Oh, boy.
To this well, children's lucky you.
Movie. Yeah.
By the way, it's a recurring theme on this show, but almost anything that really looks polished, looks like a quote-unquote real movie, you can bet that Angel Studios did not produce this. They are just a distributor for it. And because we might mention this when we talk about Testament, which is going to be the main topic of our conversation, but a much bigger podcast than us and possibly a better podcast than us, Michael and us did a recent episode on The Last Rodeo, right, which is another Neil McDonough vehicle from Angel Studios, produced by Angel Studios. If Neil McDonough is in it, you know they're doing it, right?
Right. Well, and you know he won't kiss any women because apparently isn't that why he says that he was pushed out of Hollywood?
No sex scenes. No nudity.
He won't kiss women on screen, which is
He did legitimately get let go from a TV series, and it may have been because his refusal to like participate in like a sex scene or romance scene with a different character. And I think he could still get work. I think
he's an actual good actor. Yeah. I think.
And
he's got chops, right?
Instead, he's leaning into the like the martyrdom, self-fulfilling prophecy of just like, no, I can't get work, so I got to work with Angel Studios.
And the reason I mentioned Michael and Us is that I think at a glance, if you don't kind of dive into Angel Studios, it's not apparent at first that the big media properties that they've been involved with, and by the way, that make up like a lion's share of their revenue over the past, you know, decade of their existence, basically, are not theirs, right? Because those guys too, right? They were like, yeah, these are the guys behind Sound of Freedom, which they were just the distributor for, right? And like this movie coming out, Sketch, right? They're looking for these kind of orphan completed properties that then they can kind of slap a distribution deal on and work their magic, right? And by the way, distribution itself is not without financing hurdles, right? And
no, but it's a lot less overhead than like having to, you know, actually produce scripts and bet on something and finance something. It's a lot easier to be a distributor. I mean, that's how Netflix got a lot of success at first is through those kind of deals. And they were not heavy into production until like Stranger Things era, at which point like Netflix streaming had been around for like 5 or 6 years. And they had a few hits like Orange is the New Black. But it is always harder to get into that side of things. It's expensive. It's risky. Everyone remembers, if you're, you know, a little bit older, how many of those studios folded and went through bankruptcies in the 80s and 90s. Like there were so many like classic studios that kind of took a shit as we started building towards this series of like three conglomerates are all that are left.
Monolithic. Yeah.
Yeah, by the way, exactly.
Hayden, I don't know if you've heard that Netflix production model coming out with great new hits such as Happy Gilmore 2.
Yeah.
Hayden?
I want it to be good. I love Happy Gilmore. I want the Sandman. I like Adam Sandler a lot.
Me too.
And I didn't even hate like Hubie Halloween. Like it was a fun movie for us to just sit around and get a little drunk with your friends and throw that on. There's nothing better.
I got to say, Hayden, Alec is being kind of a dick right now because a few months ago, I told him, like, you should watch Happy Gilmore. He's like, isn't that Adam Sandler? Isn't he stupid? And then he watched it and called me precisely 92 minutes later. Like, that movie was amazing.
I remember not liking it, like, as like, I don't know, like as a young adult when somebody had it on. I was like, this is like very base.
I feel like you really got to watch it when you're like 10 years old. If you grew up watching a few of those classic Sandler films, it is such a specific and like the time specific kind of humor. Like, I don't know if kids today are watching Waterboy or Big Daddy or any like those kinds of movies. It's like, but they should. They should. We got to get back to it.
I think the Gen Z generation is, just because I work with a lot of Gen Z students.
Okay.
And when Adam Sandler came to town, I told them like, oh, I'm going to go see Adam Sandler live. And they got kind of excited. And I think it's because their parents are Gen X / millennial.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're watching like, oh, my parents always put this on. It's so good.
Put on the bad kids movies.
My life has been being a series of different kinds of annoying guys. So I think when I sat down, the last time I had watched Happy Gilmore was like in college when I was like watching like Days of Heaven and trying to be like,
I'm trying to watch. I'm watching The Mirror by Tarkovsky. What is this? What does this have to say about the human condition?
I just saw A Serious Man, a very good comedy. Yeah, and this is a bit bait. And actually Happy Gilmore is extremely funny. It's very funny.
Yeah. Carl Weathers, rest in peace. So he's so good. Like, just what a comedic talent. That guy was just a fucking Renaissance man.
Truly.
We don't get to enjoy that, though. That's the thing about these sorts of things, is we don't get to enjoy a nice Sandler flick and talk about that. No, not
on the podcast that we do.
We watch the worst shit in the world, the stuff that makes you remember that there is so much evil, not just in Hollywood, but in Atlanta, the Atlanta and Provo sicko.
Exactly.
But Hayden, before we get into the show, I have to ask you, can you please tell us a little bit about the Bible Lore podcast? Tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us, why did we think that you were qualified to talk about this kind of stuff?
So I make the Bible Lore.
Us?
I make the Bible Lore podcast. It was kind of started, I was a missionary, an evangelical missionary, for several years, actually, in my early 20s. After, so I kind of gave that up and just didn't think about, you know, my whole faith life around like 2016. I was kind of like, huh, these people are going kind of hard, right? This is kind of freaky shit. And I started to, you know, I finally kind of grew up and coming back and learning more about history from shows like Chapo Trap House and a few others, kind of understanding kind of the darker parts of American history and the civil rights movement and things that are taught to you in a very sanitized manner. And so I kind of put that aside, became like, you know, your normal 2016 era dirtbag left kind of guy. And then after around the time that I got laid off from my last job, my wife was watching Supernatural, the TV show. So I start Googling about, oh, you know, I think the character is mentioned in the Book of Enoch or something that's on the screen. And I found this book called God and Anatomy by Francesca Stavrakopoulou, who's a scholar of the Bible. She's really amazing. If you know Dan McClellan, who's very popular on TikTok, he was her, or she was his doctoral supervisor. And it kind of reignited this passion for like understanding the Bible, but kind of taking a lens of like the other shit that I'm obsessed with, like FromSoft lore for like games like Dark Souls and, yeah, and Elden Ring. You know, I have like a whole lore book on Dark Souls 1, the Abyssal Archive. It's really great. My wife got it for me for my birthday a couple of years ago. And so I started kind of seeing like, you can actually look at the Bible through this sort of lens. And I really wanted a podcast that sort of took, I don't know, like a Mike Duncan or a blowback approach to ancient history. And I couldn't find one. So I realized at some point I was like, I think I have to just do this. At that point, I'd read like 30 or 40 books on biblical scholarship. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. If I'm going to do like undergrad reading, like bibliography reading levels, I might as well try and turn this into something real. And so that's what it is. It's a chronological history of the ancient Near East is what the usual term is, centered on Palestine and kind of talking about the influences and the history of the Bible. I also will have like interviews with scholars who are really smart and bring them on and kind of incorporate it to give it kind of its own flavor as a show. And I've done a few movie episodes so far that have been torturous. But yeah, that's the kind of like there's so much stuff in the Bible that people don't really know about, especially if you're raised in an evangelical or otherwise fundamentalist perspective. There are so many gods mentioned that there is an entire dictionary that's like 900 pages long that's called the Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible. That is how much is in there. So when you talk about like monotheism, that's not really a concept that they were even familiar with. It's actually a fairly recent phenomenon. And that's kind of the stuff that I am absolutely fascinated by. There's this famous, at like the very center of the Torah, there's this famous magical ritual of atonement. At the temple, I think it's at the tent, since this is set during Moses' time, they take a goat. And then it's said that like they slaughter one and feed it to Yahweh. And then the other one is sent off into the wilderness to Azazel. And that's a character that is never mentioned again. It's this kind of wilderness deity that presumably eats the goat as a way to kind of expiate the sins. There are similar kinds of rituals all throughout the Middle East at the time. Things like, and there's another one in the Bible that's similar, where you sacrifice one bird and one you put blood on and send it away. That's the kind of stuff that when you really kind of get into the details, there are all these similarities that you can find and kind of stuff that was in the background of the author's minds when they wrote this stuff that I just find endlessly fascinating.
Rituals of like the ancient Hebrews, right? By the way, I think that's the parable of the original scapegoat, right?
Comes from is the scapegoat. It's where you lay the sins of the people on the goat, and then it goes off to be fed to this wilderness demon or deity. The demon deity or demon versus God split. They don't really care about demons until like the 300s BCE. Which is kind of interesting on its own. Like a lot of their history isn't focused as much on the deities and that side of things, which is kind of until it is. And that's when stuff gets really, really cool. Like you get all this like Gilgamesh and I want to say Humbaba show up in some of the apocryphal literature, like First Enoch. So these characters that were like these heroes of this great epic, and they're suddenly just mentioned as among like the giants before the flood, which is kind of like they repurpose and use all of this stuff in the service of this grand narrative that I just find so interesting.
And possibly things that people would have been kind of aware of, right? Homages to things that people would have known at the time, right? That are in some ways, right, lost to time. I mean, I think references to Gilgamesh are well known because Gilgamesh obviously survives. And then there are some that are much, much more difficult to kind of place, right? And
right.
That's really fun. Good podcast, guys. Go listen to it. The Bible Lore podcast.
I can only speculate that there may be like some political reasons why they started to care more about demons, but I'm only speculating. So I got to ask, why the sea change? Why all of a sudden at 300 BCE are they like, we got to hype up this demon aspect of things?
So that's one of the really interesting perspectives that leads into kind of early Christianity to an extent. So you start to get under the influence of Persia after Cyrus the Great comes in the 500s and just wrecks the shit out of Babylon. And he is the first Messiah. He is described as God's anointed one. That is kind of what they're looking for, is a liberatory political force to come in and save them. Then you get under the Persians some kind of influence from Zoroastrianism. It's really hard to place because Zoroastrian texts, like texts as being important, doesn't come up until around the time of the Bible's compilation in the early centuries of the new era. That's what's really tricky. But I think there's a general consensus that there is an influence of this idea of dualism, this idea that there is a battle between good and evil that's coming, that we're engaged in and that's happening around you in the kind of supernatural realm. And that's where demons start to gain a lot more kind of purchase, where this previously God-aligned characters like Hasatan, the Satan, God's accuser in Job, he gets recast over time as the devil. Previously in the book of Job and in a few other places, there are characters called accusers, called Satan, but they are always in God's employ. In Job, he's kind of this brief character who is God is, he basically roams around looking for people to fuck with and test on God's behalf. And he comes to God and says, I got nothing right now. And he's like, I'm looking for a new target. And God is the one who says, have you considered my servant Job? And kind of puts the Satan onto Job. In this case, Hasatan is kind of just a generic member. He's not like a fully fleshed out character. He sort of disappears from the narrative of Job and doesn't get much mention. He gets, I think, one more where God actually, Esther Hamori points out that God incorrectly accuses the Satan of picking on Job when it's clear earlier in the text that it was God that actually pointed out Job. So
they wrote down that part of the conversation as well, right? That's not redacted.
It's really interesting. No, yeah, there are all these kind of seams that you can see in the biblical text that are really interesting, and that kind of emerges into this idea that is really foundational to apocalypticism, and especially in Christianity, in this, you know, good versus evil kind of fight that was not really present before. A lot of the earlier texts describe good and evil coming from God. And so with that, suddenly you've got a devil and you've got his retinue of different demons and different kind of creatures within that world. There had been demons before, but it's a little less clear. And that kind of develops and becomes really important in texts like Daniel, which was completed around the time that briefly a Judean independence movement briefly succeeded, essentially gaining independence from the Seleucids, one of the successors to Alexander the Great's conquest. After that, and it's really interesting because he's like, okay, God's going to show up and he's going to kick out all these Seleucids. And then that's not really what happens. Like, you can place the date within a few years because of how specific the political situation is described. Like he says and he's writing from the past and says, like, first you're going to get the Assyrians and then they're going to fall. And then as you get the Babylonians, they're going to fall. And then you're going to get the Persians and they're going to fall to this guy, Alexander. And then it's all using this very cryptic language, but it's pretty easy to figure out what analogy they're making. Like it's not exactly the most like cryptic language possible. Like you can decode pretty easily. And then it gets really vague and says, and then God's going to show up and do all, and that's not really what happens. But that idea continues to be influential. And then Rome becomes kind of the big beast of that period. And they're often cast as kind of the most evil, you know, evilest empire of all time. I mean, they did suck. Let's be clear. It was probably pretty bad to be a Roman vassal.
They're the villains of the show that we watched for the podcast today. So that's great.
And Rome, right? Like lasts until modernity as the kind of archetypal anti-Christian evil, right? The state force. I think basically all of those are homages to the Romans as opposed to anything in the Old Testament, right?
And it's really fascinating because of how Revelation picks up heavily on Daniel and basically says, and God's going to show up and Jesus is going to be there and he's going to take down Rome and he's going to take down the evil people in Jerusalem who are kind of repressing us. Not really what happened. They became Rome, right?
Yes.
Christianity took over Rome 300 years later. From there, it gets really complex, but that's the kind of apocalyptic millenarianism that is lying behind a lot of this stuff is this kind of anti-imperial rhetoric, which personally, I've talked to a few friends about this. It is all kind of QAnon in a way. Like it is that same millenarian mindset is just so interesting because it's like, no, don't do anything. God's going to show up with his army of angels and he's going to clear them all out.
Which we'll talk about it some more, but it's fascinating to me. Well, let's get into Testament somewhat.
Sure.
Because we watch a lot of Christian media here, Hayden. You're not going to be surprised to learn. And also you're not going to be surprised to know that a very frequent theme of modern Christian media is some form of state oppression. And that can be, it can be very vague or in the more kind of millenarian, more like tinfoil hat wearing styles. It can literally be like, oh, that's clearly like Obama, right? Or somebody like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, shout out to Homestead, where the villain of the movie is just like a low level bureaucrat in the mayor's office.
The tax man.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Special.
But finally, in Testament, right? Testament is a pretty direct adaptation of the book of Acts. Literally, like in the first 30 seconds, you're just introduced to our main character, Stephen, right? And you go like, if you know the book of Acts, you're like, well, I bet nothing bad's going to happen to this guy.
Which I should clarify, I have not read the book of Acts.
Okay.
I attended a Episcopalian school and an Episcopalian church where they're like, you don't need to read this shit. We'll tell you what you need to know.
That's
don't
too
worry.
Bad.
You're a good person.
Because Acts is very explicit, right? So Acts follows the resurrection of Christ, and it's basically Peter proselytizing, the conversion of Paul, right? It's the early church right after Christ is resurrected. They receive the Holy Ghost and a lot of cool shit happens, right? And then a bunch of uncool shit happens. There's from one side, they're being oppressed by Hebrews, let's say.
Jews.
The Jews of Jerusalem. More on that later. And on the other side,
no punches.
Yeah. And on the other side, they're doing cool shit, right? Miracles. They're handing out miracles. Like Peter is just healing cripples. He's resurrecting people, right? He's got the Holy Spirit.
God kills a couple people for not giving enough money over. Like
he
Ananias
kills people with
Sapphira.
A word.
Yeah,
Peter's
exactly.
Like the Kwisatz Haderach. It's awesome, right?
Yeah. And it's kind of this interesting genre. Acts is kind of a weird one because it seems to be taking the letters of Paul and trying to write a narrative somewhat around this character and how he gets into the early followers. It's probably early second century, so probably written somewhere around 80, 70 years after the events that take place. Like it somewhat contradicts what Paul says. It's trying to make sense of these whatever surviving letters that they had and then slot that into this narrative where Paul and Peter are like good pals and everyone gets along really well. Like in Galatians, how he, because he's our only source essentially that's contemporary. There have been suggestions that maybe some of his letters are later, but they're generally seven of the letters that people think probably went back to the actual Paul. And one of those, Galatians, early on, he goes in on how much he did not get along with Peter. He doesn't talk about these people very much at all. He doesn't talk about the historical Jesus. He doesn't talk about his interaction with the other apostles much. But the one thing that he does seem to say is that him and Peter did not get on because Peter seems to have wanted to keep this as a fairly specifically Judean idea, and he calls him like one of the circumcisers, like one of the club that wants people to get circumcised when they convert. And whether cynical and recognizing that, hey, circumcision for an adult man is a high barrier. That's a high barrier. This thing's not going to take off if we keep telling people to mutilate their dicks. And so there is this kind of that's the tension. And then we don't really hear anything else about it, about like, did they ever get along after that? The book of Acts smooths over basically all of that and basically wants to give this hagiographic portrayal of these heroic apostles.
And it is effective at making this kind of glorious narrative of the rise of the early church and of spreading the message and embodying the Holy Ghost in continuing the kind of miracles of Jesus. And that is pretty refreshing for Christian media, because finally, at least there's some scriptural basis for these like tropes that exist like throughout them. Acts does describe oppression by the Jews and by the Romans, right? And then there's a bunch of miracle, right? You're not making kind of vague homage, right? You're just like, hey, this is what the book says. This is what it would look like if it happened in modern times, I suppose.
It is weird, because probably my main issue with Testament, besides the fact that it's really boring and that it only appeals to people who are already sold on it, is that there's no reason for it to be set in modern times.
No.
Like, and in fact, it begs questions of like, why? Nobody's out with their phone out, like filming someone doing these mirrors. Like, it doesn't really engage with its setting in any way that makes sense. Instead, I almost feel like, and this is just me wondering, if because of the way that the Roman Empire is vaguely portrayed, it makes me wonder if they wanted to get into like the YA, like Divergent or Hunger Games type of setting, because that's what you should do, right? Those are apocalyptic works typically of authoritarian governments, and that kind of young adult fiction sort of thing would be, I guess, an interesting framework for this to be set up in an interesting setting, at least appealing to the people who like that shit. I don't like those kinds of movies, frankly. I think most of that kind of stuff is really boring.
I think a lot of Christians don't like them either.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough.
Well, you know, Divergent was super popular because they do always have these oppression narratives that appeal to people with this kind of persecution complex that they can sort of read themselves into. That is where I'm like, they could have really leaned into that and made it, especially with how young they portray a lot of these people, they could have leaned into that more.
I think if they had just had Hunger Games or Divergent or Maze Runner or pick your own post-apocalyptic young adult novel, if that had come out when Alec and I were in high school, we would not have started the Ron Paul chapter. We would have just been like, oh, yeah, this is me. I am being oppressed and forced to participate in these daily games when the coach is yelling at me
by not smoking weed.
Yeah. But I do want to touch on, Hayden, what you said about it being set in the modern day. Because my theory, first off, this is from a company called Warlight.
Yep.
Yeah, which is a UK-based production company. And they do a lot of faith-driven stuff. I don't know if, because a few months back, Angel Studios signed a international distribution deal with a company in the UK. And I need to do some more research to find, is this a result of that? Or was
How did they finance this is my big question, because it's not like really, really good. And I know the barrier has been lowered a lot on equipment. But that is the kind of question I had, because the UK does not have the evangelical side of things to the extent that, like, they don't have the mega churches that finance a lot of the projects. So that is my question, is how the fuck did this get made?
So
This guy was born in Spain. His mom was English. His dad was Norwegian. He grew up in the UAE. So I have a feeling that daddy's got money.
We're referring to the founder of Roar Light Productions, which is Paul Sørstad.
Yeah. Right?
Did he direct this as well?
He wrote it and directed it, yeah.
Yeah, yes. And they previously made a movie called, like, Testament Parables and something
the
or
parables
else.
Parables Retold.
I think that's what it was. Actually in the theme. None of this has been started by Angel, but the kind of maybe modern iteration of this is Angel, where you get a bunch of investor money and then you have all these projects. And so what Angel does, if you've ever kind of looked under the hood, is you can come in as an accredited investor. If you got 10 grand lying around, you can call up or go to their offices, I suppose, in Salt Lake City or Provo, right? And say, I would like to invest in a project. And that project is going to be one of their upcoming kind of media products. And you put your money in and then you, sign a contract and you get some of the proceeds of the profit. Also, if you've been following Angel Studios, it's questionable whether or not they will actually receive these.
Nobody is getting paid.
If you're not one of the accredited investors, if you're at the kind of lower tiers that they've created, right, for guys that just have $100 sitting around, you might not get paid. But this is the kind of like investment vehicle, and I think they would actually call it. I think I've seen some marketing material from Angel Studios where they kind of call it like crowdfunding. This is not really crowdfunding, right? This is investor funded, right? As opposed to going out and getting a loan from a bank, which probably doesn't want to have anything to do with media productions that are Christian, right? Or maybe media productions from just like lower end studios at all, right? You can go to people that at least share some kind of spiritual religious background, and those people are more inclined maybe to share the money, right? And just looking at kind of Roar Light's social media presence, their website, right? They're very much kind of in that mold, right? Not necessarily started by Angel Studios, but very similar. And then they're farming out, right? They're making these products and then they're farming out to any basically just Christian kind of distributor, anybody that will have them and take them and get some money for having people watch this. There's another angle to this, which I would like to follow through with at some point, but I see a lot of overlap between the kind of stuff that marketers and CEOs, for instance, of places like Roar Light will say and straight up just VC language, right? So when they're talking to investors, they sometimes kind of hint at the idea of building this thing up so that they can be acquired and possible stock options later and this kind of stuff, right? Like series funding.
Although their goal for all of these places to become like, Warner Brothers is faith partner or whatever. Like I think Sony has one that's called like Sony Light or something like they all have these kind of generic faith-based names. And so you will get stuff like, I think Zachary Levy has made a few movies with one of these, labels that are in that vague kind of space of like, and I think the one that The Chosen is working with is Amazon MGM now. That's the one that
literal
they've gotten.
Casino.
Yeah, which is very interesting.
And I mean, there are people who do it explicitly like this, and there are people who do it like kind of behind closed doors. I've talked, not on this podcast, but I've talked to other people about Trillith Studios, which is where like all of the Marvel movies are shot. And that's owned by the chairman of Chick-fil-A, Dan Cathy. And what do you know, since Ant-Man, that might be the last movie that Marvel has made that had a kiss scene in it. These completely sexist movies that are being filmed at this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's very.
They got to get Neil McDonough in there. See, he'd do great in these Marvel movies.
Oh,
he
man.
Doesn't have to kiss anybody.
Kang. Yeah, recast Kang.
That's right.
That's interesting that he hasn't been like maybe looked at. I would hope that like he at least auditioned, because the Marvel movies have become entirely sexless, right? They're very kind of neutered in their attitudes towards sexuality and relationships, which is.
You wonder if he's just like an annoying person. Like I think Kirk Cameron, the fact that he was a Christian wasn't why he was not put into movies after the 90s. It's because he was very annoying.
Yeah, look at Chris Pratt. Working with
him. Yeah, I mean, that's it's just annoying is the main thing. Like, do you want this fucking guy on set?
Yeah, maybe he's a jokester, or he's just like always nut checking people or something.
A jolly prankster.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and pivot into Testament here. I want to start off this series, this pilot has an opening coda that is four phrases long. For centuries, the Roman Imperium ruled the district of Salem. Its people in the temple had long hoped for their prophesied liberator. Yet when a rogue preacher was suspected of being this Messiah, the temple deemed him a heretic. He was killed, buried, and his followers fled. Weeks passed, and whispers circulated that the crucified man had been seen and his followers had returned to Salem. And then, on the morning of Shavuot, commonly known as Pentecost, something new began. And I wrote, damn, that's long.
Yeah.
That's a lot of text.
It sets you up to think that this is a chosen style, like a historical retelling, yeah. Right? That it's going to be set in Judea, right? In like
and
Roman
Judea. It basically
Judea.
Is.
And then the first scene, there's like a refrigerator. It's like, what?
It really is basically that. Like, there is nothing in this that couldn't have been put in a period piece, except for the budget.
Exactly. Like,
yes. I think
the real reason why it's not. But because of that, there exists this weird tension of like, why the fuck are all these people British? Why does this look like a suburban British neighborhood? What is the actual political economy of this empire?
Hey, I would argue that if you want to make a retelling of the Book of Acts and you're light on budget, there's no better place to do it than the dystopic police state that is England.
That's true. The Starmerite factions are always out there harassing people on the streets. I've heard all about it.
In their red, like Halo Spartan uniforms.
They put a lot of money into the guard uniforms. That's all of the fucking budget went.
All into elaborate uniforms. I thought they looked pretty cool. It reminded me of The Last Jedi. It's like, ooh, all right.
Off with you to the poor district.
Yeah.
and so funny.
They have like a curfew too, which is kind of, there is an element of that, which is kind of fascinating that, again, if they really wanted to talk about these things in the context of the time, that is something that has been put forward by scholars like Jim Crossley and Robert Miles, who wrote a great book called Jesus, A Life in Class Conflict, which kind of talks about Roman political situation and imperial control in Judea in the first century. And how, like, when you did have these big gatherings in Jerusalem for these festivals, it would kind of be like the Super Bowl or some other place where every single hotel room is sold out and the city is kind of brimming at like twice the capacity it's supposed to be at. And so it is a hotbed, and it's very possible that that's why the real Jesus was crucified. If he caused some sort of ruckus around the temple district, they're putting your ass up on the cross.
And by the way, the Romans are highly motivated by things that are good for business, right?
Yeah.
Because this is not a model that is unique to Judea. This kind of like festival atmosphere surrounding some kind of religious rite, right? Or,
yeah.
or anniversary, right? This is like hundreds of years old, like within the kind of like both the Roman Republic and the Empire. They love, by the way, like inculcating these like local things. And they're like, hey, man, people are going to show up, right? Whenever you make this a holiday, a jubilee, right? Guys are going to show up. They're going to be staying at the hotels. They're going to be eating food. By the way, there's lots of taxes to be collected.
Oh, yeah.
It's good for everybody.
don't
make trouble.
And that's one of the funny things about this being low budget is that they talk about it kind of in those terms, but you never see the big crowds. Like, you're never seeing like sweaty shoulder rubbings. Even the homeless encampment is kind of spacious. Like when they show that, it's very like, oh, this is the nicest like homeless encampment I've ever seen. These like the very generous spacing for everyone there, and everyone seems to be taking care of each other. I'm like, wow, this is kind of model solidarity among the poor here. Really, really good setup in the Roman Imperium, Shalem or whatever they call it.
Yeah. It, by the way, like the subplot of Stephen's mother named Esther here. I can't remember if she features in the Book of Acts. It's been forever.
No.
But she like reports of the goings on of like the Christian, I guess, faction, right? They're doing all this heresy in the town square, and like the town council, right? These I suppose, which are supposed to be the kind of the council of rabbis or whatever.
They're Jews. The show pulls no punches of just being like the Jews killed Christ, and they're
They did, starting it with Acts is actually very clever on their part, because if they did have to get into kind of, for example, the Gospel of John's rhetoric about the Jews, this is something that the Chosen has run into, which is that you can't do it while maintaining like fealty to and closeness to the text without getting anti-Jewish, or as we would call it later, anti-Semitic, because these do have very anti-Judean bents. You know, it is this kind of sectarian battle, and they consider the authorities to be wicked and evil and portray them in pretty nasty ways. And basically, again, the Gospel of John is the most explicit one that really hammers home that it's the Jews who did this. And that's an issue that the Chosen has run into, where people are like, wow, this is very nice to the Jews, until they start getting closer to the crucifixion. And from there, you can't really dodge that. Now, Acts is a little bit nicer in that point, because they eventually leave Judea and Galilee. And so then you can be like, no, the real bad guys are Rome. But parts of the Gospels go an extensive way to separating Roman responsibility and Pontius Pilate's responsibility from like being very clear, it's the Jews. And this is something that was taken up in later apocryphal writings, where like the amount that Pilate has to do with the execution of Jesus, which, to be clear, he almost certainly was the person who ordered this to happen. He was probably one who, again, had to try like 20 cases in a day. They brought this insurrectionist in front of him, and he just said, "Not put him up in there. Put the INRI right on there. I'm nailed right in." That's what that stands for officially, I think, on the cross. And
next,
as it goes, next. And as it goes along, as these tales grow and the lore and the legend of Jesus grows, you eventually get things like Pontius Pilate becoming a Christian himself. Like there are stories about that develop. Like they really seem to be like, no, Pilate was actually a great guy and he got his life figured out. The Jews.
Passion of the Christ, the portrayal of Pontius Pilate is like a torn man who has to consult with his wife and does everything like, but what about Barabbas? Surely you would rather him die. And he just feels like betrayed by the people that he has to kill Jesus.
It's so much funnier if he's like a hapless bureaucrat, right? Yeah. So he does the next thing, line of guys getting crucified. And then later he's like, so this Messiah you guys are talking about, what's his name? And they're like, Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And he's like, oh, fuck.
there must be two of them.
he's rifling through the files.
There were three Jesuses who were different messianic preachers. So he probably, he could have been like, probably wasn't that guy. I was probably not even procurator at that time. I wasn't the prefect.
A lot of guys named Jesus.
It was probably Herod Antipas or something like that.
Testament pulls no punches. There's literally a scene where you get like the shadowy back room and they're like, we had the Romans kill that guy. It's like, they're just very explicit. The Jew, the old Christ.
I really do love that scene where, so Stephen is, to skip along a little bit, Stephen is with all the other, I guess, followers of Jesus. I think they've been baptized. Yes. They have all been baptized.
They get baptized in a swimming pool. Which is like, God damn it. I hate evangelicalism. It's just, it is the Marx quote about everything solid melting into the air. Because there is this beautiful like symbolism, I guess you could say, of like the Jordan River is this very famous and important part of this geography, and it's stripped out of that into being like, and they baptized him in the YMCA gym
pool. All that matters is water, right? We lose all of the like naturalism, the kind of the peace that comes with going a place and doing this at a specific location that might be holy, right? Well, I mean, a large body of water that's not polluted with lead in England, that might just be the pool. That might be the only place you can...
That's... I respect the Catholics a lot more for kind of how they treat everything as very sacred. And Protestants get upset about that. Some Protestants, especially evangelicals, do and be like, you're deifying all this. It's like, yeah, but you also transported the baptism of Stephen, like one of the most famous guys, into a fucking British swimming pool. Like, that is demonic. Like, I don't believe in demons. That is from Satan himself. That is from Beelzebub. That,
well, that special shout out to the Righteous Gemstones for opening up their entire a group baptism in a wave pool.
that is what it is. It is so close to a parody that you would make about evangelicals.
While I appreciate you saying something nice about the Catholic Church, the church that we sometimes go to, my wife's Catholic, and I guess Catholic by blood, does feature one of the tiled jacuzzi style a dunk tank baptism pools.
Goddamn, so, American Catholicism is
sorry,
just,
man.
we've got
hey, this is Louisiana, dude. We're not taking people.
There's the Calcasieu River.
Right. Yeah, you're lucky if it's like, all right, turn the hose on. We're gonna baptize you.
It's just like a Sea-Doo driving past.
Right. I was just
like a marsh. Everybody just covered with mosquitoes.
I was just in Florence in Italy, and they have like this repository of the jawbone of John the Baptist or something. And it's like, you are not getting that at an American Catholic church. You're getting like the PC that the most recent saint owned before he died. Like, that's check out our reliquary of like the toenail clippings of Saint Buzz.
We're having our bishop canonized, and this is his ashtray.
Yeah, we got Father John's Crocs in the back.
That's where you build it up, because in 100 years that'll be interesting. And in a few hundred, you stick that in there, and they're like, they wore Crocs. In 200 years, you get the reliquary of Saint Buzz's Crocs. That's the real shit.
Oh fuck!
So to bring it back, after everyone's getting baptized and all the apostles here, Stephen's mom Esther does show up, and she starts yelling at everyone, saying like Jesus was a blasphemer. And the direct quote was, "We were all there at his trial. We all shouted, 'Crucify him!'" At trying to be like, "You're all guilty."
Yeah. All of us Jews said to crucify him.
Hey man, sometimes you get caught up in the moment. There's a crowd. It seems like the vibes are going one way, and you say some stuff that you might regret. She's trying to cancel them.
And then Esther is so upset about this that she does go to a friend of hers. He's the father of Saul, basically. And
Gamaliel, maybe? Is she friends with him? Okay.
Yes.
And he was a real guy. So just to give some background on him. So she reports on her son to one of the Sanhedrin. So the elders are the Sanhedrin, and multiple towns could have elders and have Sanhedrin, but it was a high ranking position. Typically, you would be a member of like the Pharisees or the Sadducees if you were elected to those positions. So Gamaliel, though, is a very famous one in like rabbinic literature. Paul never mentions him in his letters, but the book of Acts, to lend him a certain amount of gravitas, says that he was attached to Gamaliel, which, again, Paul was never one to hold back on bragging about himself and all, and how he goes into, look at all the persecutions I faced. And he says, I was a Pharisee of Pharisees. I was one of the best Jews of all time. I would be surprised if he didn't mention that he was a student of the famous Gamaliel. So they do include this guy, but the historical reliability of that in Acts is questionable, to say the least.
What's interesting about that scene with Esther, Gamaliel, and the rest of the Sanhedrins, is that what you said?
Yeah.
What's interesting is Esther tries to explain what's going on, and they cut her off. Like, you do not have a voice here. If you speak again, like, we're casting you out. And they basically like, all right, so what did she say? Okay. Yeah. And
silence, woman.
It's very interesting. They really ham up, like, we're evil, we're sexist.
Yes.
and like, and we had that Messiah killed.
I have to point out how funny it is to have like this world where there's this oppressive police state, and then they need like an old lady to come to them about a large gathering in a public place where people are like shouting blasphemer shit. It's like, this is not a very good police state you guys are running here.
It's bizarre.
It's a police state without a surveillance state. I've been thinking about this, Hayden, since you said nobody's bringing out their cell phones. And like that is something that could really be, if you want to bring this story to the modern era, lean into cell phone, lean into social media, lean into virality. But that's a completely different story.
But Peter's doing like miracles on like Instagram Live, and they're like, sending.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have faith if it's like well documented and put online. Then you know it. Like, that's guess that's a narrative challenge, but that's a you problem, not a me problem.
Yeah, that is the issue that this kind of stuff always runs into, is that they are at cross purposes with the art itself, right? Like when Scorsese does The Last Temptation, one of my favorite kind of adaptations of the Jesus story, he gets weird with it. He allows it to be odd. It's like the novel that it's based on. It doesn't have to, it can be artistic, and he can have these kind of contradictory things that his Jesus says and have these weird scenes that are beyond the text, but they want everything to be historicized. And that's just not going to come through, because the text that it's based on is not real history, right? Christianity did not have this explosive growth where suddenly, like within a decade or two, thousands and thousands of people are all over the kingdom. Like, it was relatively small. It slowly grew. And from what we see, the Romans didn't really know anything about it until like the early second century. Like, our first attestations are from people writing about this period. Like, the first encounter we have with a Christian is Pliny the Younger in like 105, 110, something like that. And he's writing to the emperor and being like, I ran into this weird cult. They were accused of all kinds of shit, like sacrificing kids, or like, I don't remember the specific accusations, but it's like incest and all this other stuff of like calling each other brother and sister. And he's like, I tortured some of them, because that was the process at the time. And I don't think there's anything wrong with them. I'm just going to let them go. Let me know if there's anything else. It's this kind of like, that's kind of how the Romans approached it for a long time. The tales of like persecution and crackdowns don't seem to like have much basis. Canada Moss is a scholar who wrote a book called The Myth of Persecution that talks about like how you can see all of this develop and how they kind of insert themselves into Roman history a lot. So why not? Just if you're going to make something that's set in the future, that's not actually set in the time period, and these texts are not historical, you can mess with that. They cannot, though, because they are evangelicals. This has to be two things that it can't be at the same time, you know, historical and accurate to the text. And then it has to be set in the present day. Like, you have these three very conflicting perspectives that are butting up against each other. And it just makes for fucking boring ass TV.
It should be said that like the Romans barely noticing the Christians, right? Like, the Roman Empire is abound with weirdos doing cult shit forever. These guys are not unique in any way, except that basically they're the ones who kind of end up winning eventually in kind of European culture and like history.
Over like a 400-year process nearly. Oh, like, course, it took centuries for this to happen. And so it accretes all of this lore and stuff. And I the only thing I'm kind of curious about is how Catholic they're going to let it get, how much they're going to actually lean on the early Christian tales. Like, there are things about, there's this fascinating, there's this character, I think he appears in Acts, called Simon Magus, or Magus. He's like a magician or something like that. I think he has a confrontation with Peter in Acts. Now, that gets expanded a lot, and there has been like some speculation about whether Simon Magus is standing in for Simon Peter, and kind of like the difference between Pauline and Petrine kind of perspectives on what Christianity should be. But it's very, very, very fascinating kind of stuff. And I'm like, I wonder how much they're going to actually try and get into the weirdness of early Christian writing that is outside of the Bible.
My sense, at least, Hayden, this is a British property, right?
Yeah.
My sense of American evangelicals, who I, you know, I guess, you know, interact with on a kind of day-to-day basis, that, by the way, some of whom are not Catholic and basically do not like the Catholic Church much, is that there's a vague sense that somewhere between the church becoming the Roman Empire, which is glorious and good, right, because it ends most, let's say, aspects of Christian oppression or the ones that they're interested in, right, and is kind of sanctified by Christianity becoming powerful in a way that's interesting for other reasons that we don't have to talk about. And the middle ages, at some point it becomes corrupted and they're not all that interested in really defining the contours of that or when that happened and how. Right.
Right. It just doesn't really matter. That is always the issue, is that all of these people hold to the Nicene Creed, right? Very specific conceptions of the Trinity, which creates an issue because it's not there from the beginning. They are always going to be these evangelicals at a crossroads between trying to decide for themselves when Christianity becomes corrupted, while also having to ignore that a lot of the weirdness came before Nicaea, where they like constant. So at Nicaea, they, and this is something that I find really interesting about this show, that I want them, my own like screenwriter brain is like, oh, this is how I do it. So one of the first things they address at Nicaea before they, common myth is that they decided on the Bible at Nicaea. That's not really true. A lot of that was kind of already there to an extent, and it wasn't really officially like some of the Bibles that Constantine and later emperors received contain books that are not in the canonical Bible, like the Shepherd of Hermas and other books that were very important to early Christians. But one of the first things they do talk about at Nicaea, besides the big Trinitarian Arian controversy, which still wasn't fully settled afterwards, they talk about prohibiting people from castrating themselves. Because a big part of early Christianity is, and this is something that Paul takes up, is this asexuality. They see in the very Greek philosophical sense, sex as this dirty thing. So, and it doesn't matter to Paul. He's like, just only have sex if you really got it. If you really got to get married. But otherwise, don't, you, that's icky, kind of. That's fleshly, that's worldly. And that's kind of an interesting part of Christianity. It is part of other Jewish sects at the time that had a negative view of sex. So that's one of the first things they have to address at Nicaea when they have finally the weight of the emperor behind them to really hammer home and figure out these controversies. And that is one of the parts of apocalypticism that they're going to have to confront in this show, is that they expect him to come back. Jesus is supposed to come back before all of them die. Some of you will not die before seeing the kingdom, the king come in all his glory. That is part of and parcel of the early Christian movement.
I wanted to say, you mentioned the thing about the first thing they need to talk about is self-castration, because I'd be curious, and if you can't speak to it, that's fine. We can find somebody that can speak to this. But the historical significance of castration, because when you mentioned Cyrus at the beginning, like, you know what? The only thing I retained from Xenophon's Education of Cyrus when I read it in college was that the eunuchs are the most loyal person. If you cut off a person's nuts, then they have nothing left to lose.
That's in Matthew
results
as well.
they might kill you.
That's in the book of Matthew as well. So he says, let me pull the verse up here. This is when Jesus is intensifying the law, which is something that's kind of unique to Matthew. Jesus is a lot like the Pharisees. That is actually why there seems to have been such a headbutting between them. They're both kind of these resurrection sects that believe in some kind of apocalypse with the resurrection of the body. That separates them from the Sadducees, who notably don't believe in the resurrection. And so Matthew is more like the Pharisees in that, like, his Jesus like loosens the law in some places and says, don't be an asshole about the Sabbath. But then he also intensifies it. And he says, Moses said that if he gave you divorce, I say any man who divorces his wife is committing adultery and gets remarried is committing adultery. And this is what it says in Matthew. The disciples said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. But he said to them, Not everyone can accept this teaching, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let anyone accept this who can. That's where a lot of this comes from, is this idealization of sexlessness. And that's where I wish the show would have leaned into that a bit more. Like the conflict between Stephen and his mom should have been like, he tells her, I've joined this cult of sexless weirdos. and I'm trying to, but also I would like to bring a lot of them over and have a sleepover at our house. Like, that could have given her much clearer motivation to tell him to fuck off and be like, you're get the fuck out of my house.
Yeah.
What the hell is wrong? As it is, like all of the character motivations in this need you to already accept why they're being oppressed and why, like, you are, they kind of gloss over that and don't give you any context. You are supposed to already accept they're oppressing them because they're hiding the truth or whatever. And that's the kind of failure of a lot of these Angel Studios. They say they want to like spread the gospel or whatever. What it realistically is just entertainment for people who are already sold.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody's going to watch this. If you'd never heard of Christianity and watch this, you would not understand like half the shit that is going
Absolutely on. Absolutely not. This text is like, is basically impossible to understand if you're not familiar with Acts, I think, already. Or you're just like, this is so fucking weird, man. like none of this, none of this makes sense. I'm turning this off.
I think if you brought this into the modern era, given what you just said, Hayden, like Stephen and his friends should be waving like, you know, the black, gray, white, purple, asexual pride flag.
And that's
like,
right.
Mom, we're ace now.
we're this guy Jesus told us to become eunuchs. It's really exciting.
That is particular. I've never thought of that like in either the modern iteration or the historical one, the favored group has to be both presented as revolutionary and changing of the status quo and normal, right? And it can't be both, right? Because you can't off-put the audience by making them seem like a bunch of weirdos that are starting like a cult, right? Which is absolutely what that would have felt like if you lived in, Salem, right? If you lived in ancient, in Roman Judea, right? You'd be like, who the fuck are these guys, man?
And yet
you have to make it feel important and like worth changing society for.
So a subplot within this episode is the discovery of a new drug that may or may not be a parallel for fentanyl. It's not really made clear. It comes in a very expensive looking vial. So immediately it's like, this can't be fentanyl if a homeless guy is just begging for money. It's like
it's like the world's biggest auto injector. Like it's like how Pfizer justifies selling you insulin for whatever rate that they have. They're like, look, we put it in this fancy new sci-fi tech.
Oh, I thought it looked like one of those cheap off-brand gas station vapes. Right. And it's like we've discovered a new kind of stimulant that makes you very sleepy.
I didn't understand that at all. I have no goddamn clue where they're going with that.
All right. Well, all episodes have been released on Angel Studios. The finale airs in just two mere days.
Meeting with bated breath.
Excited Squidward.
Yeah, I guess my other question would be, like, do any of us want to keep watching this?
Nope.
No.
I would prefer very much not to. It's just so much of this is so incurious in the writing. So like Stephen's mom talks in this perfect like British almost posh accent, and they're supposed to be on the imperial fringes, which is so like, it's so weird how they don't even try to do that because of how low rent a lot of this is. I think she does a good job, and all of the actors in this are fine. It's whatever, but like if any of these people had a mindset that looked at things outside of like individualism and this very, very Protestant worldview, you could create, again, something interesting, something weird. You could have like an accent in a TV show should give you some idea about the character and about like their upbringing and like their class position. They're not portrayed at, like the Jewish characters are not portrayed as Jewish. They're essentially portrayed as English in a very specific way. Their accents are English. And I think part of that is to stem off any accusations of anti-Semitism. That ain't going to work because it's still anti-Semitic as fuck.
Stephen, you have to come here. We're reading the Yiz call for your father.
All right. Yeah, I don't want to do this anymore, Mom. I don't like this. For those that are unfamiliar with ACTS, Stephen, our protagonist, is basically not long for the world. He's going to get stoned to death, and we don't mean on stimulants, right? He's like, people say he's like the first martyr for Christianity. He's one of the first like canonized saints in the when they established canonization. So he will be killed, right, for his transgressions. And I might like try and skip to that episode just to see how they handle that, just to like see what they do if he just gets like unceremoniously shot in the street.
I will reconsider this show if you send me a scene of him getting absolutely beamed with rocks, like in gratuitous, really like they busted all the budget on him just getting hit in the face with rocks.
Pelted with cobblestones.
Maybe like even you could get like, and then they finish him off with guns. If they use real squibs in this, I might be back on board.
Guest directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Just gushing blood.
You know, I don't know if Paul Verhoeven seems to be struggling to get his movies made. He would be perfect for this kind of thing. Absolutely. Bring back Paul Verhoeven. I want to see Steven looking like what's it, Peter Weller getting blasted in RoboCop and just getting shredded by rocks.
That director's cut of the original RoboCop. Where the guy just getting like obliterated.
Yeah, that's what I want to see Steven look like. If they do that, I take back everything bad I say. I'm on board.
Oh man, we all know in our heart of hearts he's gonna die off screen. They're just gonna tell us.
Yeah. The other thing I'm curious about is that like we've said, right? Like Axe is chocker block full of miracles, right? Peter's doing miracles, Saul converts, he's doing miracles. And one of the things is like, I'm recalling correctly, like Peter kills with like a word. He's just like, I'm very disappointed in you, and like a guy dies. And I'm so curious if they like include that in there.
Oh, they are going to. That's the thing. Like this show has the miracles, which are not always very cinematic, right? They heal the paraplegic guy, Caleb or something like that. They even try for like a fun scene where he's like, oh, look at me pushing him on this makeshift wheelchair, but they don't really commit to it. So it's, I don't know, it's very bad. But yeah, that they are definitely going to kill. I think it's Ananias and Sapphira is who it is. And basically what happens is that they're required to give money to the church. And this is one that was often used in teaching growing up. They're supposed to, like they say, oh, we sold everything we own and we gave it, and I think they keep back half or something like that. And Peter asks them, are you sure you gave everything? And they say, yep. And God strikes them down, and like Peter says something, and then God strikes them down like right where they stand, just struck dead. God kills way more people in the New Testament than people realize. I mean, most of it's in Revelation, but he does kill a few people.
I will say, right, like I'll reiterate that I am at least positive about this, and that it is not necessarily a like annoying and kind of like confounded modernization of something. It's basically, so far, it's kind of one to one. It's pretty mediocre there, but you know, I think that's better than like, have you seen, what's the other Angel Studios one, Connor, with the evil future?
Fuck. Oh, The Shift.
The Shift.
I listened to some of your episode on that, but I haven't seen it.
It sucks, man. It's worse than this, I'd say.
It's true. When they get into kind of the speculative aspects, and that's what I'd worry about with this show, is that they tend to really, like, they insert whatever they've got inside of themselves, and all of they've got is, like, contempt for their audience and a lot of preaching and bludgeoning you over the head with the same things you've always heard. Like, it is just all rote evangelicalism. And that is true. There is less of that than in, say, like, I watched Left Behind, which is very much in the vein of kind of this stuff, high budget, low quality. And it is mostly boring, except for the preaching scenes, which are not boring, but are very tedious and like and eye rolling. And like there was that one movie that came out 2025. It was like that low budget German guy who
married
one of his students from like he was a youth pastor who married one of his students or something like that, which is awesome.
Is that the one where the Bible has been outlawed and they collect all the pages to build the Bible again? Yeah, I saw a trailer for that. Being in Houston, Texas, if I see one of these movies or one of these Angel Studios, even adjacent properties, I see like 13 trailers and realize there's a whole world that I'm just like not a part of.
Yeah. And this is one of the less frustrating ones. I still, fully admitting, I put it on 1.25x about, I think, 10 minutes in this movie, because they pad out the time on these properties so much. Like they speed ramp at the very beginning. They do like a slow motion walkout of some of the, I think it's some of the apostles, and it just like, come on. Mm-hmm. Like why it's already too long and too boring. And then you just pad the fuck out of every shot, every establishing shot, everything. Like if you cut this down a little, you could put this into like a 25-minute edit easily.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very frustrating. Like you're not on TV. You don't have ads. You don't need to hit that 44 minute. Cause like, maybe we'll get on AMC. It's like, you're not.
No, straight
to Angel Studios.
Yeah. This is not hitting syndication.
I just looked up that film 2025, by the way, subhead, The World Enslaved by a Virus.
There it
is. I'm guessing there's a COVID.
It was, I think they produced it in 2020 and 2021.
I have never actually seen this. The user reviews are around 1.0 out of 10.
It's beautiful. I recommend just checking, because so much of it feels like, And a lot of it is that the production quality is even lower. The difference is that this show has budget for ADR, whereas that they often record with like a boom mic sitting too far away from people to record a full conversation.
Yeah.
They don't. You can't even understand half of the. And all the scenes are them just talking about that the government's conspiring against us. What are we going to do? What is Jesus? It's so bad.
I'll say this. Any show that says we don't have the budget for ADR, you are not being inventive enough. Sound dampening in a closet can do fucking miracles.
It's crazy. Like, again, these people aren't just incurious a lot of the times about like creativity, but also about production and stuff like that. Again, you could make Evil Dead on like a Friends budget back in 1980. Like you could make Clerks. You just have to be willing to have something to say and be willing to put in the work to actually say it. And this kind of stuff is kind of this is better, but it's very lazy. It is a very lazy show. There's no real creativity going on.
I'm going to give some free advice to the Hayden. We have a conspiracy that Angel Studios obsessively listens to our podcast.
Great.
Because they did. Quote me once, which was fucking
funny. I'm not joking. We literally believe this.
Like, phenomenal.
Yeah, they have
to. Hi, guys.
Yeah.
Hello. Hey, guys. I love Mormon lore. It's
Aiden's really like, fun. I need a job.
Yeah, give me a job. I will argue in print that Asherah is Jehovah's wife. Absolutely. And that it always was. I'll do it.
So for anyone listening, please, please, please read Robert Rodriguez's Rebel Without a Crew. It's the diary he kept while making El Mariachi, and it is a great lesson on how to make a movie on a budget. The technology has obviously gotten better, but it will teach you how to like do ADR in a closet instead of paying thousands of dollars for to rent a studio.
Yeah, if Sean Baker can make like Tangerine for like $100,000, you guys can be spending your money better, right? Like,
yeah, the problem is you have no talent. Sorry. All right, I got one last gripe I want to say about this show, and then
let's do our
wrap up, which is you see a bit of graffiti that says "Death to the Imperium."
Oh God!
And this is a world building hang up I have, and I was talking to Alec about this in our pre production. Why not why not take the time to like develop some slang? Like we say pigs, ACAP, fuck the 12. Like we have all these other things that we say in replacement of I hate the police. So why not just lean into it? Be like death to the imps or like down with imps, something like that. Give me what do the people?
Well, imp is little people, so I don't know. They might get into trouble with like. I think you might get some phone calls.
Then
over,
the reds.
I get it. Yeah, that's the right.
The reds.
Yeah,
wearing,
exactly.
Like, or the Praetes, and for short for Praetorian, something like that. Give me something. That,
right.
Because also, if you're a rapscallion on the streets, tagging walls, are you really going to take the time to write out death to the Imperium? No, you're going to be like, I got to get this really quick and then run. Ah, it bothered
fuck
the, hell
the
out of
congressional
me.
Parliamentarian.
That's
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
I think the problem, Connor, is that the writers of that show might not be familiar with the fact that people use slang.
Like, yeah, the slang they all know is like tied up in evangelicalism. And if you say that stuff out loud, it makes me want to kill myself because I'm familiar with a lot of it. And that's the kind of like their entire all of their shorthand is completely divorced from living in broader society. The people who make these kinds of things are very siloed off a lot of the times. I talk about this sometimes, but like there was I think Pew Research did, and I'd have to dig it up. It's been a minute since I looked at it, but a few years ago they did a survey and found that like as far as evangelicals, at least in America go, they're the least likely to have friends who are of a different faith from them. Oh. Every other segment of the population is close friends. I think the closest you get are Mormons. And that's they are these very sectarian and separated people who don't consume the media you do to the same extent. They don't interact with like they don't hang out even with the same kind of people. Like it is a very isolated group. And that's kind of, let me tell you, it does not produce great art.
No.
Can I get one piece of slang, Hayden?
Oh, fuck.
That I like. All right. No.
Let me think because
it's painful.
It's all things like, you know, I'm doing spiritual warfare right now by
I've heard
like,
that.
Oh, there's a whole lot of that kind of language that doesn't really make sense. I'd have to look it up. I feel like
why don't they just say
in the
90s. I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I'm doing internal jihad. Well, that would take for them to understand Muslim concepts of jihad outside of like the views that they have, that it's all about like death to America. But again, it's just all in curiosity. There is no part of them that has any interest in understanding other people. And it shows in this slop that they put out.
All right. I think we answered it, but do you want to hit them with your classic question?
Yeah. So is this propaganda?
Yeah, it is. It's propaganda very much in the way that a lot of these properties are. It is a very specific evangelical kind of propaganda. Dan McClellan often talks about how apologism is like apologia is never for, it's not for people like us. It's right. Not for you if you're on the outside. What it really is for circling the wagons for the people who are already inside. And that is the way that a lot of this kind of propagandizing does function, is as performing confidence for yourself and for those in the inside. And that's kind of that's why these movies make money and you've never heard of them. And that is kind of the way that this all works, is that they can tell themselves, this is an important evangelistic tool. This is a tool for spreading the gospel. This is a tool for spreading the truth, but it never penetrates outside of that. And it just doesn't work. What it works to do is to further insulate themselves from broader society. So that's how I see it.
Yeah.
And I don't know about Warlight, but in the case of Angel Studios, also explicitly to make a pretty damn good living, right? Because I don't know about Warlight again, but like one of the strict, I'd say, innovations of Angel Studios is the pay it forward model, where you say, well, this made actually a lot of money. And then it's like, yeah, but 75 to 90% of it played to empty theaters paid for by church groups, right? For tickets that were never given to anyone, right? Like,
and Hayden, I think you hit the nail on the head earlier in the record when you said like this gives you like so little context, it's not going to convert anybody. You don't really learn anything about what's going on in this world.
Yeah, like a lot of those kind of YA books and movies, they spend a lot of time developing why these people are oppressed. And they, like, sometimes it's very simplified. You don't really understand why here unless you're already coming to it, accepting that Christianity is always under attack by the outside world.
Alec, what is I just saw your shirt. What the fuck are you wearing? Where did you get
this
that?
This is, well, you know, this is a turbo lib friend of mine that we're working on his politics. But he sent me, as a way to gloat, he sent me this Kamala Harris t-shirt. I don't know if you guys can read it backwards.
It's forwards. I see it. Yeah.
Falling out of our coconut tree. And then whatever the quote, like, existing, yeah, like, to, like, you know, Xanax blabber that, like, Kamala
got
in front of a microphone, and which I did not wear. And I put away and I said, this is fucking annoying. You're annoying. But when she lost the election, I began wearing it because now it's extremely funny.
Now you get to gloat.
Absolutely.
It's a nice good cotton shirt. I mostly wear it to bed. I don't wear fucking graphic tees in public, much less political. Can you imagine? God damn, dude. No way.
Yeah.
That's actually a great shirt. I love that.
Falling it's awesome.
It's beautiful.
It's like so perfectly emblematic of, like, how vacuous, like, all of, like, 2024 was. It's perfect. Love
so,
it.
Hayden, we're going to wrap up, but I want to give you an opportunity to, you know, tell the people listening, where can we find you?
Yeah, I'm Hayden Tank on most platforms. You can check out, and the Bible Lore podcast is on most platforms. You can join as a free member at patreon.com/BibleLorePodcast. And I have bonus episodes, bonus interviews. The main chronological story is obviously going to be on the free feed, but I have interviews with scholars and other folks on the paid sub. And you can also just support the show. Or, again, free ride. Nothing wrong with that. So check it out. I'm about to get to the fall of Jerusalem at some point. The 7th century is a long one, let me tell you. but the Assyrians and the are about to be overthrown by the Neo-Babylonians, and that's going to be an exciting time. So you got plenty of time to catch up, and really, thanks again for having me on, guys. Really, really had
great.
Fun with this one.
Absolutely,
so.
Yeah. Man.
You were an ideal guest for this. this was probably the most informative Angel Studios episode we've ever had.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, about the text, not about Angel Studios.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, that's true. You guys actually uncovered stuff. So I did a little bit of research before I did my episode. And when I was listening to one of your episodes and you were talking about kind of the specifics of their incentive structures and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, that's actually stuff I didn't come across. So good on to you guys as well for doing some of the research on that and diving into
possibly,
that insanity.
If I could possibly justify it, Hayden, I've considered becoming like a class A investor in Angel Studios just to like literally be in the room, or at least like, I don't know, maybe like petition them and say like, what do you guys have on offer? What are like the upcoming things as like,
I have to request that, like, if you do this, you cannot vote. It's like,
to observe. We can't influence.
That's right. Well, you can't. Yeah. I mean, there is always that rule of don't tap the glass.
True.
But I also don't care because they're freaks.
Dude, I am so between the two of you, I'm so taken with the idea of this being produced over again, but being like a feature length film. Directed by like either Tarantino or Paul Verhoeven, like acts.
I would love, you know, so Paul Verhoeven, not to get us on another tangent, he was actually part of the infamous Jesus seminar in the 90s, which was this scholarly like attempt to find the historical Jesus. It was like the big quest for the historical Jesus. And he was a voting member, which I don't think the Jesus seminar was particularly helpful in establishing the historical Jesus. I don't think we can. There's very little that we can say with confidence about the actual guy, besides that he had a small following and got crucified by the Romans in Jerusalem sometime in the early 30s. And he was probably born in Nazareth. There's not a whole lot outside of that. that we can say about him, but he was interestingly part of that. And that's been like a big bugbear for evangelicals and more conservative Christians ever since. And that's one of the things they use to like discredit it. And it's like, you know what, motherfucker, Paul Verhoeven is actually smarter than like 99% of you. He is actually, I think, a pretty sharp motherfucker. So yeah. I would absolutely, if I had a council of guys that I wanted to establish, I would put Paul Verhoeven on any one of those easily.
Let's go.
Yeah, wouldn't even second guess it.
Okay. Well, on that note, Excelsior Propaganda, then as always, keep your eyes on the skies.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
I was a fool to wander and stray, for straight is the gate and narrow's the way. Now I have traded the wrong for the right.